supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, today's Saturday, March 3rd, and I'm at the Art Museum at the Van Gogh exhibit. Today's show, of course, is about Van Gogh, the nature of his mind, the nature of his life, and the relationship between creativity and madness, mental agitation and alienation. As I go through this exhibit, I am struck by what his paintings are doing to those who observe. Everybody is so moved and so taken in by the colors, by the precision, by the life behind the painting. I can see genius. I can see an agitated mind. I can see a man wanting to focus narrowly on pieces of nature, and I can see an artist here who knows that he is simply part of nature, no more and no less. Well, now back to real time in the studio, and I'll introduce my guests. And here we are. Here we are back into real time in the studio. So, joining me to talk about this pairing of creativity and madness are Stephen Naifi and Barry Panter. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stephen Naifi's new book is called Van Gogh, The Life. It's written with Gregory White Smith. Steve joins us by phone. Steve, welcome to the show. Do we have you? Okay, well, we'll go on and introduce Barry Panter. Barry's a psychiatrist and the founder of Creativity and Madness Conference. He's also written Creativity and Madness, Psychological Studies of Art and Artists. He joins us by phone. Barry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know if you heard my intro, but...
Yes, I did.
So I said in his work, you can clearly see his brilliance and his disturbance. And as a clinician, I of course, wonder about his history. I know he was born 1 year to the day after his brother, who was also named Vincent, and his brother was stillborn. I wonder what impact this might have had on the way he was viewed by both of his parents. I mean, he truly was born in his brother's shadow.
Well, the problem of the replacement child is been researched, and there's been a great deal written about it. The child who died is often viewed by the parents as the wonder child. If only that child had lived, he would have become the president, the greatest artist in the world, the greatest everything. So the child who takes his place, and in the case of Vincent, 1 year exactly to the day, that child can never really measure up to those outlandish and unbelievably hyperbole expectations. So the child always grows up with a feeling of, I'm not good enough. I'll never measure up. I'll never be able to. And I think that's certainly what happened to Vincent.
But he
also grows up in the shadow of death, because Vincent van Gogh's parents put a gravestone in back of the church where the father was the pastor and where they all lived. And on that gravestone, it said William Vincent van Gogh. So every day of his childhood, Vincent walked by a gravestone that had his name on it.
Well, we will see over the course of the hour today how that became kind of thematic, his kind of struggle to find his connection to his parents and his own identity. But I want to say right up front, I mean, he had a variety of severe psychological illnesses. And I do want to say that, you know, feeling as though you're not good enough for your parents does not cause things like bipolar disorder.
No, of course not.
Steve, I want to come to you. We've got you on the line now.
We sure do. Sorry that the last connection apparently didn't work, but this one is working.
That's okay. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I don't know if you got to hear the opening discussion with Barry Panter, but
I got a bit of the replacement child syndrome issue.
So tell us about how this affected his work, if it did.
Well, it's been in the literature for a long time, and it's, of course, a striking coincidence that his older brother was born and died the same day that to the year that he was born, and therefore it's hard to imagine that it didn't have some effect. We question just how big an effect it may have had. The gravestone that he would have passed his older brother's gravestone was not in the direct path from the parsonage to the door of the church, so he would not literally, in the literature it's suggested that he had to pass by it every Sunday, and that's not entirely accurate. And another point that sort of needs to be made is that infant mortality was so common in 19th century Europe that it isn't, it certainly left an enormous amount of grief, but it was far more common than it is today. And it's interesting, although perhaps it may signify the level of grief, that they never ever mention it again, but I think it's important to note that the issue is never raised by the parents or Vincent himself ever again. And as you, I think, said importantly, there's so much going on with his psychiatric problems that they're sort of overwhelmed by this replacement child issue. It, to the extent that we think it had an effect, it's that it isn't the fact that this older brother might that Vincent felt the older brother might have been better. It would have been the reflected feeling that the mother might have wondered if that the older brother might have been a less difficult, more rewarding child. Because right from the very beginning of his life, he was a, and even, you know, even before he was old enough to really sort of process the fact that there had been a prior child, from the very time he was born, he was a, the words the family and the family's retainers used were things like eccentric and weird and bizarre and difficult. And the family, as is almost inevitably the case, if a child is unlikable, it's hard for parents to like that child. And when there's a differential as great as the differential between Vincent and his younger brother Theo, who was charming and sweet and helpful and good-natured, and he was the child every parent wanted, and Vincent was really disliked by, it's perhaps too strong a word, but it really fits, especially for the mother, almost from the time he was born.
Well, I want to turn to Barry, because one of the things you're bringing up, Steve, is the concept that a lot of temperament researchers come up with, and that's goodness of fit. So if the infant's temperament doesn't fit with the family's temperament, that poor child's going to be in trouble, and it sounds like that's what you're describing. But
well, you've got the terminology. I wasn't aware of the terminology, but I think it. But I'm eager for Barry's thoughts on this. But it certainly sounds like a very good way of describing the problem that defined the early stages of their relationship right through to the end of his life.
Barry, I want to shift a bit back to the mother. I mean, we know for sure that Van Gogh always longed for warmth and acceptance from his mother and never received it. But And we know she was relentlessly critical of him and his work. But I wonder if she was also depressed, if she was clinically depressed through this process.
I think there's some pretty good evidence that she was depressed. In his one of his paintings is of the La Berceuse. It's a painting he did when he was living, I believe, in Arles. It's of a woman very content and very happy, and he wrote to his brother Theo that he hoped that that painting would someday be on a ship, and that the men who were far away from the people they loved, far away from their mothers, would look at that and would be comforted by the thought that that's their mother waiting patiently for them. Hmm. Also, the paintings that, the sketches that Vincent did, there's a painting that he did of Sienne, the woman he lived with in Brussels when he was just starting to paint. It's a sketch of a woman who is in great sorrow. I'm getting it confused. This is a painting that he did of, well, it was of Sienne, the woman who
right.
he was with. But also, he, if you look at that sketch, the letter, it forms the letter K, and K was the first initial of his cousin, whom he was in love with and wanted to be with, but she refused him. So there's a lot of sorrow in his paintings and in his sketches, and I think that goes along with the theory that his mother was depressed.
I think Barry makes a really good point there with La Berceuse, which is one of his most famous images. And what's striking about that image is the mother. It's not a happy mother. It's a she's got a grim look on her face, and even more interestingly, the baby doesn't even. It's a portrait of a mother and a child in which the child is missing. The child is in a cradle that is off canvas, and she is supposedly rocking the cradle with a rope, but the rope is slack. So there is he depicts this mother consciously or otherwise as being completely disconnected from her child.
I've studied Van Gogh for a long time. I never really noticed that in that painting.
Well, it's really sort of shocking. You think that the whole purpose, as you quite rightly said, Barry, was that he thought he was painting a pictorial version of the ceramic figurines that sailors put in their boats to comfort them during terrible storms, and this comforting image is anything but comforting. And he was. Anyway, there's so much to talk about here because the family relationships are so profound, and his psychological problems are so many, and how all that connects to the art is really an amazing topic.
Then let's get to some of those things that that we do have to talk about. We're talking about not just Van Gogh, but the relationship between creativity and madness. And my guests are Van Gogh's biographer, one of them, Steve Nafee, and
right.
I've got psychiatrist Barry Panter on the line. I want to look at Mahler. Steve, you talked about that when we spoke with you earlier. You talked about his sixth symphony, the tragic symphony, and he grew up in a family in constant mourning for several of his siblings that died. But are you suggesting that unhappy childhoods produce artists who produce sad things? After all...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, one of the things that's so fascinating about Van Gogh is that this life of sorrow is so overwhelming. I mean, having spent 10 years in it, we were sort of inured to the pain and the suffering and the loneliness, but they were at a catastrophic level. I mean, when he was in the Borinage, I mean, it is hard to imagine someone more alienated, more unhappy, more just uncomfortable with life. His time in Drenthe, when he was entirely by himself. I mean, this was a man who frequently had his interactions with others restricted to the to ordering his meal at the cafe each day. He was desperately lonely. he was desperately terrified that not only was he insane, but that the insanity would prohibit him from having anything approaching a normal life or completing his career. But even though those the portraits that we just discussed of the mother are rather grim, most of his paintings, if you take the mother out of Berceuse, the painting itself is a rather joyful painting. He uses this Provençal wallpaper in the background to give the background of this grim image this wonderfully joyful sort of jubilant these sprays of flowers, and he used the red and green color contrast to also give the painting a certain joyousness. But if you think about his work as a whole, especially the late mature work, the work that we care about so much, I mean, it is hard. One of the great mysteries is that he could pull these very happy paintings, these sunflowers, of which you own one of the great examples there in Philadelphia, or the irises, or especially his flower paintings, but that fabulous spray of almond branches that end the show in Philadelphia. So many of his landscapes are lush and just full, bursting with life and excitement and beauty and contentment, Barry's the real psychiatrist here. I'm just we write psychological commentary in the form of biography, but I think one of the astonishing things about Vincent, and one of the things that makes him so life affirming for people, and one reason why he's so popular, is that he was able to pull these incredibly jubilant paintings out of this deep well of sorrow that was his life.
I wonder. We've got to take a break in just 1 minute, but I do want to turn to you, Barry, about a condition he was born with. He was born with temporal lobe epilepsy, and as a result of his being born with a brain lesion, I wonder if this could explain an awful lot of what we're seeing, the goodness of fit problem, maybe even the mood swings.
Well, Dan, I don't know that he had temporal lobe epilepsy. It was certainly one of the diagnoses that has been given to him posthumously. I don't believe anybody examined his brain. There were no reports by neurologists, I believe, who made that diagnosis. And during the course of since he died, the last time I looked, there were 187 different medical diagnoses given to Vincent van Gogh, medical and psychiatric. So take your pick. It depends on what type of which specialist you're talking to.
That's just a variation on what happens today, anyway. But there's.
Would you like me to address? Because that's a huge topic, and obviously we spent years looking into it. Barry's absolutely right. There is no definitive diagnosis, but the consensus among the psychiatrists who've spent their lives periodically studying Van Gogh, there are dozens and dozens of diagnoses. By far the most authoritative ones, and the principal proponent of the temporal lobe epilepsy diagnosis was a great French psychiatrist named Henri Gaston, who wrote repeatedly and brilliantly on the subject. But very interestingly, his own doctors at the asylum in Saint-Rémy diagnosed him as having epilepsy. So his own doctors diagnosed him as having epilepsy and found confirmation in it, in the fact that so many members of his family had it. There are at least five or six immediate members of his family that had epilepsy, so it was in the family. And we know that since he didn't have grand mal seizures, that they knew he didn't have grand mal epilepsy. And we also know from the fact that his psychiatrist in Arles, that psychiatrist's roommate at the medical school in Montpellier had done his dissertation on what the French at the time called epilepsy larval, which was the term used in France at the time for what we now in English call temporal lobe epilepsy. So it is our opinion that his own psychiatrist believed that that's what he had, and having read the bulk of the psychiatric literature coming right through to Martin Blumer in recent years, and I believe that the Van Gogh Museum itself has sided with temporal lobe epilepsy as the principal diagnosis. But the complicating factor here is he pretty clearly was bipolar, and he had syphilis, and there may have been other diseases on top of that, and Barry would be a far better source than I would be on the complex interplay of multiple medical psychiatric problems. I assume it is not rare for an individual to have more than one psychiatric disease.
Yeah, they do tend to go together. I'm going to have to cut in because we do have to take a break. We'll be back in just 1 minute with Steve Nafee, who's Van Gogh's biographer. He's written Van Gogh, The Life, written with Gregory White Smith. Psychiatrist Barry Panter is the founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. I realize I haven't given out the phone number. Partly it might be because I wanted to be selfish and talk to these guys myself. But our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're going to be talking about the relationship between a disquieted mind and creativity. I'm not comfortable with the word madness, but a disquieted mind and creativity. Again, 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY. FM.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY. IBC is proud to launch the new Independence Blue Cross Foundation, whose mission is to transform healthcare in the communities they serve. The foundation's Blue Safety Net program provides $2 million in grants to local nonprofit health clinics that offer quality healthcare for the uninsured in our communities. The foundation supports more than 30 clinics that care for more than 145,000 individuals in underserved areas. To learn more, visit ibxfoundation.org.
Voters from Georgia to Alaska and in plenty of states in between are set to weigh in on the Republican presidential nomination. I'm Melissa Block. 10 contests take place tomorrow, and we'll bring you the latest results and analysis, plus reaction from across the nation. Special coverage of Super Tuesday from NPR News.
Tomorrow night at 8 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Steve Nafee, Van Gogh's biographer, Barry Panter, a psychiatrist who studies the relationship between creativity and, for lack of a better word, madness. And Barry, let's follow up with that. You're the founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. Do these words have to go together?
Well, they don't have to go together. The disturbed mind, I think, describes it also. In terms of our conferences, we started with the title Creativity and Madness because one of the first lectures presentations that I gave was called Vincent Van Gogh, A Study of Creativity and Madness, and there's little argument that at times he was mad. But over the years, a number of artists have heard about the conferences and come, and some of them have objected to that title. So we changed it one for several conferences to Emotional Growth and Creativity in Adult Life. And it didn't arouse nearly as much interest as the title Creativity and Madness.
Yeah, it's not a sexy title, the other one.
It's a fascinating subject, and it sounds like you're a central expert on this, Barry. Obviously, during the 19th century, there was there were a lot of people who believed that there was a kind of coming together of extreme behaviors, whether it was criminality or insanity or creativity, and it's one of the things that put Van Gogh on the map because people looking for a representative of that confluence of behaviors Van Gogh was a perfect example of that. But the thing that has struck me is that there's some perfectly happy, normal guys and girls out there who paint happily and brilliantly. I don't know of any sense that Henri Matisse was disturbed in any way. So there's obviously, at least in my mind, no one-to-one correlation between a disquieted mind and creativity. It seems that one can be creative either with a disquieted mind or without one. It doesn't seem to be a necessary factor. I assume you've given that issue
a good deal of thought. Are you familiar with the work of Kay Jameson? Kay Jameson is a psychologist, a clinical professor at Johns Hopkins, and she did a study a number of years ago in which she interviewed creative artists in London, in England, and artists, poets, and their family members. And she found a very, very high incidence of affective disorder, major affective disorder.
Well, that's interesting.
Depression, alcoholism, suicide. And in the general population, the incidence of those of an affective disorder of that magnitude was somewhere in the teens, I believe. But among the prize-winning artists in Great Britain in her study, the incidence was in the 80s. So
that's certainly not madness, but
there is certainly an affective component to a great deal of creativity.
Did she hazard a guess as to why the correlation was so high, or have you guessed as to does art perform a compensatory or a self-medicating purpose in artists' lives? How would you explain this very high correlation?
Steve, now you just stole my interview, because that was exactly what I was going to bring up. That was part of my observation when I was at the exhibit. We did a when I saw the Van Gogh exhibit, I thought a great deal about mindfulness meditation and how he would focus literally on a blade of grass in order to calm his mind. But you know, when I learned to do that as a meditator, and when other meditators do that, it does it. It calms the mind. And to a certain extent, when that happens, you don't know that you're part of nature. You just feel part of nature. And there's no I. There's no more personal pronouns there. You are just part of nature. It's a very serene feeling. But, you know,
So your feeling is that for the artist who's content, there isn't as much need for to turn to that kind of a focused activity as a relief from the burdens of a disquieted mind.
No, not at all. What strikes me about Van Gogh is he did experience himself as part of nature. After all, when he took his life, he took himself to nature. But at the same time, there was not this serenity that one would ordinarily experience when you're that intimate with nature, because his mind was still quite agitated. So, you know, his hand, his creativity was drawing beauty, and his mind was agitated and dark.
Dan, if I can
please
add something to this. I think I'm becoming the advocate of madness. But the artists, I believe, struggle with great forces, internal, psychological, emotional forces within themselves. And they have great difficulty in controlling them. So the art becomes a way, their way, of attempting to externalize these raging forces. And by externalizing them, in some way to view them in the hope of mastering them. And very, very few artists ever really master those internal issues. So this leads into a phenomenon called perseverative creativity. Some artists, many artists, they just repeat the same theme, the same emotional theme, over and over again in their works, attempting to master it.
Do you see that with Van Gogh's?
Yes, I do. The themes of death, the theme of death is certainly there, and the theme of the wildness, the cypress trees with their branches like tentacles reaching out to you, the wheat fields, ominous forth, are there to express the agitation in his mind, and perhaps the epilepsy, the epileptic seizures of the figures that he's trying to master in some way by externalizing them.
Steve, I want to turn to you.
Sure.
He felt that all artists of all mediums, in their own way, tried to reach the divine. And this is from a man who was a Christian missionary prior to the time he took up painting in earnest. Can you tell us about his relationship to religion? And I'm wondering if there's any kind of grandiose thinking here?
There's a great deal of discussion of this, because he really wanted to be a preacher longer than he wanted, or at least as long as he wanted to be an artist, and in this great long trajectory of failure, he failed in it as he failed in being a teacher. And in being an art dealer, you know, he would have inherited the family business, which was the biggest in Holland, and he kept being demoted until he was thrown out of the gallery and refused admittance. As a teacher, he just simply couldn't stay in school long enough to get the training to be a teacher. And in religion, he wanted to be a preacher, but again, he couldn't get the academic training necessary. So then he wanted to become a missionary, and he couldn't. He failed at that. He couldn't pass the test, and he ended up being a distributor of Bibles, which is the very lowest rung. And so he kept on failing at all of these different activities. They were all, in some ways, a reflection of a family member, meaning that his uncle, Sent, who had no children, had been a very famous art dealer, and so he was trying to imitate his uncle. But he also had, even though he had a very complicated relationship with his father, his father was a preacher and a very happy one. He took a great joy in his activity as a minister, and there is a very powerful statement from Vincent in his letters to Theo, in which he says, "Oh, to have had a life like Pa's." So he wanted desperately that feeling. But what's interesting is that the feeling about being a preacher that was so important to Vincent wasn't the Bible, even though he studied the Bible and knew it well. And in fact, he read it in four languages, but it was the feeling of comfort that a preacher could bring to his flock. It was bringing to life St. Paul's notion of sorrowful but always rejoicing, of taking sorrow and turning it into joy. And when he becomes an artist, he merely transfers that ambition to bring comfort and joy to the sorrowful from the sphere of religious activity to the sphere of art.
And, of course, he's also looking to bring comfort and joy to himself also.
Absolutely.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Steve Nafee. He's Van Gogh's biographer, and he's written Van Gogh the Life. Barry Painter's also on the line. He's a psychiatrist and founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. Let's see if we can get a phone call on before we go to break. We've got Michael on the line.
Yes.
Hello? Hi, Michael.
Hi. Yes, I'm sorry, I'm driving right now. My question is this, I've been a music teacher for 25 years, and I've taught people composition. I've been writing for that amount of time. I'm a little edgy about analyzing creative people almost like gerbils in a wheel or something. Some people create, some people don't, and all of them who create are very sensitive, but they've ranged between people being schizophrenic that I've known and people who are just, you know, had a little bit of a rough go at it being somewhat happy. But I don't think you can really analyze why people create. I think it's a mystical thing almost.
Michael, I appreciate your call. I appreciate your question. We're going to get to it, but I want you to hang up that phone quick and concentrate on your driving and listen to the radio. You'll get your answer there. Thanks for calling. And Barry, let's pass that on to you. This discomfort about analyzing creativity.
Well, Freud, in one of his famous quotes, said that alas, before the artist, psychoanalysis must lay down its arms.
Hmm.
And I agree with Michael in a sense that it's such a gift, the creativity. It's a gift that the artist has from wherever, from God, from nature, from his parents, genes, whatever. And the artist creates gifts that he gives to the world. I mean, certainly Vincent, with all of his suffering, look at the joy, the pleasure that he has given to millions and millions of people all over the world. So, but as far as analyzing it, their lives and their art, they're so interesting that one can't help, at least as an analyst, I can't help but be interested and try to understand it from the theories of my field. And I'm sure that applies to people who are in other fields as well.
And
as a biographer, obviously, I feel completely the same thing. One of the things that's kept people from analyzing Vincent as thoroughly as possible is this uncomfortable feeling that somehow, if we think of him as crazy, if we think of him as mad, that somehow this will diminish the art. And it is our strong belief that it doesn't diminish it at all, that Vincent was hardly the only disturbed person in history who created great art. I think one can agree with Barry's gorgeous quote from Freud. Whatever status Freud may have at one time or another, he was certainly capable of one hell of a gorgeous thought. You know, even if we can't come to complete terms and understand fully through analysis the creation and the meaning of a work of art, we are failing the artist and the process of understanding art if we don't at least try. And the one of the strongest proponents of this was Vincent himself, who believed very strongly, as he said, quoting Émile Zola, the great French novelist, that the man behind the painting was more interesting to him than the painting itself. So these artifacts are the creations of complex human beings, and I think as gorgeous as Vincent's paintings are, and they are gorgeous, what's stunning is that they are beautiful to people of all ages and all races and all, and,
yeah, and
they've
Steve,
been beautiful.
And I add to what you said, not only does introducing the concept of madness into trying to understand an artist, not only does it not diminish the artist and the art, but I think it even enhances it.
Gentlemen, I hate to cut in here, but we do have to take a break. We're running over time, and boy, I love hearing this interaction, and I do hate to cut in. You were listening to Steve Nafee, the Van Gogh's biographer, and Barry Panter. He's a psychiatrist and founder of the Creativity and Madness Conference. We'll be back with more about Van Gogh, about the relationship between creativity and madness, right after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Colorectal cancer is the second deadliest cancer in the U.S. It is also one of the most preventable. For most people, successful prevention begins at age 50 with a skilled colonoscopy for the detection and removal of any precancerous polyps. Accuracy is crucial. The gastroenterology team at Fox Chase brings experience and expertise to this important screening regimen. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
Former American Idol winner Ruben Studdard has been out of the spotlight in recent years, but now he's put the finishing touches on a new album that brings us up to date on all the joy and heartache he's been through recently.
It's like giving your own therapy session without having to pay the $115.
Ruben Studdard tells us more about his new album, Letters from Birmingham, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about Van Gogh and the whole issue of creativity. What are some of the elements that go into it? We're talking with biographer Steve Nafe, psychiatrist Barry Panter. Like most perfectionists, Steve, he was pretty insecure. I wonder if, as a perfectionist, he ever experienced the emotion of satisfaction.
Yes, you know, one of the reasons that it was so exciting to study Van Gogh, in some ways it was so much more gratifying than studying Jackson Pollock, our previous topic, was that Pollock so rarely spoke and almost never wrote anything down, whereas with Van Gogh you have these absolutely spectacular letters, and even if you can't take them as verbatim truth because they had an agenda and they were written for a specific person for a specific purpose, they are just an outpouring of genius and of insight, and there's no question that he long before he began to achieve some sort of recognition in the last 6 months of his life, which is when it happened, there were individual paintings, individual works that he really felt were good. It's something perhaps Barry might be able to analyze this better than I can, but in the middle of all this suffering, in the middle of all of the self-hatred because he couldn't get his any love from his parents or respect from his friends or recognition from the art world, one thing that kept him going, producing towards the end of his life a painting a day and many of the masterpieces, is that there was a strong will to survive and to paint these paintings. I mean, he had an incredibly good eye. He really, really understood art. He had a tremendous judgment in discerning the good from the great from the good, and he really could come home from a day of painting and feel completely satisfied that he had done something important, even though there was no feedback from the outside world.
Well, that's
confirming that.
That's gratifying to hear. But I want to turn to Barry and challenge something you said, Stephen, or maybe offer another point of view. So we know that 2 years before his death, he produced, like Steve said, some of the most significant paintings of his career at a rapid and feverish rate. But I wonder if at some level he knew he was going to die soon and just had to produce what was inside of him as while he was still living.
Well, I don't know of any of the references to that, but Steve, probably you do.
There are
references. But I'd like to go back
to
the comment about his being happy with his work at any moment. I think there were paintings that he was very, very satisfied with. However, as you know, his father was a minister, and the teachings of that particular religious area were that a father, it's sinful to take pride in a son. So I think Vincent and his brothers probably grew up with that sense of it's sinful to take pride in your work. So within Vincent were these two conflicting forces, one seeking the recognition, seeking the praise, and the other saying, no, you can't do that. You can't have that. That's sinful.
See, I want to come back to you, Steve, about this issue. You said there was evidence that he knew he might be dying soon.
Well, not so much. I think he was less concerned about dying young than about the being completely engulfed by his madness. He was terrified that the madness, because, and again, Barry's a better expert on this than I am, but as I understand it, each psychotic episode of temporal lobe epilepsy makes the next episode more likely, and he was quite understandably, and it's such a terrifying disease, that he was terrified more that he would be engulfed by his madness and unable to produce any more work than that he would actually die. And so he actually wrote about wanting to get as much work done as possible, and in fact he made lists of crazy artists and how productive they were. So he was certainly worried about whether his he would remain sane enough, long enough to be able to create these to create these masterpieces. And it related to what Barry just said. Not only was there this sort of Calvinist feeling that it was sinful to take too much pleasure in your accomplishments, but there was a related phenomenon, and that is that Vincent conceived this personal notion that to compensate for his failure, he developed this philosophy that people would be punished for success. And when he finally began to achieve success in those last 6 months of his life, he was incredibly ambivalent. On the one hand, he had an almost childlike glee that people in Paris were talking about him and saying what extraordinary things he was doing, but then he would immediately wonder, my gosh, if I've been as unhappy as I've been as a complete failure, how much unhappier will I be if I'm actually begin to be a success? So he was profoundly ambivalent about the recognition that came to him beginning in January of 1890, the year of his death.
Well, he did say that in a letter to his brother Theo, I think it was one of the last letters he wrote, he said, I generally try to be fairly cheerful, but my life is also threatened. He says the very root and steps are also wavering. So he must have had a sense that he would either lose his physical life or his psychological life pretty soon.
One of the terrible things about temporal lobe epilepsy is that you have this fear that the next episode is going to come along, and he lived in constant fear. I mean, my co-author in this enterprise has had a brain tumor for 37 years. In fact, our first time on 60 Minutes was to celebrate basically the fact that he had survived this thing for so long, and that was 14 years ago. In the middle of finishing the book, he had a massive cerebral hemorrhage that almost killed him, and so I had a first-hand view of what it's like, because there was every sense that he might have another cerebral hemorrhage, of what it was like to wake up every morning thinking that your neurological situation, right, might render you, if not kill you, at least take away your reason and your your consciousness as you know it. And it was terrifying. Greg was certainly terrified by it, and Vincent writes about the terror in his own letters. So there's no question that terror was a counterpoint to almost every day of his life.
Let's see if we can get a phone call in. We've got Daniel on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's really, really, really interesting show. I'm an artist in Philadelphia, and I'm actually a teacher, an artist teacher, and I just kind of, I adore Vincent Van Gogh's work, but I find it problematic that people associate, it's kind of like the curse of Van Gogh for the artists that came after him, that they associate madness with creativity, and there was a link made of that earlier in the program, and it seemed to me quite close. There was this kind of idea that, you know, creative people are 80% more disabled affectively or something like that than other people. And I'd like you to address that, because I don't feel that, from my knowledge of the art world, that really artists are, you know, any more mad than anybody else.
Barry?
Well, the idea that 80% of the artists studied by Kay Jameson had major affective disorders. One can look at that as being disabled, but one can also look at it as being gifted. Another gift, Dostoevsky had epilepsy, and you can read it in his works. The sentences, they jump up and down, and they're like spikes of an electroencephalogram. So disabled or gifted, I think the affective component is there in many artists. Maybe not madness, but an affective, more greater sensitivity than other people.
Well, I would think at the very least, you know, we just did a show on poetry with Ellen Bass. And we talked about the nature of the poet. And at the very least, you've got to be able to see the world in a, quote, different kind of way than your average, well, I don't know what average means, person. You've got to have your own unique take on the way the world looks. Barry?
The artist, I believe, is a lover. For Vincent to go and stand and look at an iris and to look at the wheat fields hours on end, he had to love what he was doing. And I think that implies that the artists have a great sensitivity to their emotions and to nature, and they are affected more by these sensations and by these perceptions than other people.
And I would imagine, Steve, you agree?
I think it's an exquisitely rendered thought, and so I think that one of the things that's one of the reasons why this subject has not been studied as much as we would like it to be studied, and why I think I admire you for making it the centerpiece of this hour-long program, is that we're all, or many of us, are just uncomfortable with this idea that there may be some sort of connection between madness, maybe not universal connection, but at least an episodic connection between madness and sensitivity. And I don't think that we need to be scared of it. I think Flaubert had epilepsy. Lots and lots of artists did, and as I said to Vincent, to make himself feel better, he would make long lists of artists who suffered from some sort of mental disease.
And that we're going to have to end on that point. Unfortunately, we're out of time. You ended with a comment that Vincent was always looking for connection, and that is a very human phenomenon. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. We've been talking about the Creative Mind with biographer Stephen Nafe and psychiatrist and author Barry Panter. Thanks so much for joining us today. Next week on Voices, we'll meet some and talk about stay-at-home dads. We can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and you can reach our production team at voices@whyy.org. If you want to download today's show or listen to past shows, go to whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Mark Cierner is our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer, who tried to help me pronounce Mark's name. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
In Philadelphia.